Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. HRN is food radio supported by you. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
This episode is brought to you by Roberta's, home of Heritage Radio Network for 10 years. Learn more about Roberta's at robertaspizza.com.
Hey, welcome to Beer Sessions Radio on Heritage Radio Network. This is Tuesday, May 23rd, 2023, and this is actually our second episode dedicated to Cask Ale that we've done this month, in the month of May 2023, and this is pretty cool. Let's go around the room and everyone introduce themselves. We'll go Steve, then Neil, then Todd. Steve?
I'm Steve Hamburg, and I head Cask Mark Americas, representing Cask Mark in the Americas.
I love it. And yeah. Neil?
Hey, my name's Neil Callahan. I'm the beer director for Brickstore Pub in Decatur, Georgia.
All right. And Todd?
Hey there. I'm Todd DiMatteo, and I'm one of the owners and the head brewer at Good Word Brewing and Public House in Duluth, Georgia.
All right. So, you know, for me, like last month I was in Boston for the NERAX, the New England Real Ale Fest, and it made me realize just how much cask ale is one of those joys of on-premise. And, you know, all the time that we spent drinking cans in the pandemic, especially in the Northeast, things like cask, we kind of forgot about. So let's start with Steve. So Steve, we've talked a couple of years back, and I know that Cask Mark is a big thing in the UK. And I remember when it was first coming into the States. So tell us your involvement with Cask Mark, what it is, and just kind of how it's different now than it was 5 or 6 years ago in the States.
Well, it's always been, I think, of course, the theme of the show back then was cask is a niche of a niche of a niche. if craft beer is a niche of a beer market, then cask is the niche of a niche of a niche. And it hasn't really changed that much. But in the post-pandemic period, I think we're seeing an embracing of kind of things that are more traditional in brewing. Thus, you know, now particularly that on-premises opened up. I mean, in our show back in 2020, it was supposed to be live, but we were probably the first casualty of the pandemic. And from a cask mark standpoint, the pandemic really hurt what little we had in terms of pubs and tap rooms that were affiliated with Cask Mark. So now that things are gradually opening back up, it's been really nice to see more places that are interested. Whereas beginning, when I inherited this from Paul Pendyke of UK Brewing Supplies, so he was just so busy with so many of his other stuff that he said, "Hey, Steve, why don't you do this?" And it wasn't that big a deal because we, you know, there were probably 8 or 9 places in the United States, and most were in the Northeast U.S. So New York, Philly, and of course, NERAX is in Boston. So the affiliated places were mostly New York and Pennsylvania.
Just tell us what Cask Mark is, because is it Mark with a, is how many E's? Is it M-A-R-Q-U-E-E?
Well, that for whatever reason, they spelled it M-A-R-Q-U-E. So that means everybody calls it Marquee. But it's really just Cask Mark. So it was an industry program. Basically, if you figure that cask ale is the traditional form of service in the United Kingdom. People in the industry, in the beer industry in the UK, a lot of people don't realize is that from in terms of draft dispense, cask market's really just a small percentage, even in its homeland. So, you know, we're talking about if it's big numbers, it's less than 20% of draft beer output in the UK is cask. And that had been declining. And then those who are really the biggest proponents, the brewers, many small traditional breweries who were really into cask beer and maintaining it, they were concerned about the overall quality. So they came up with this scheme that sponsored through brewers and pub companies that run sort of independently, that would do independent assessment of cask ale at pubs so that consumers would know that, hey, it's not that the beer is really up to snuff in these places. That places that apply for cask mark and get certified have passed independent assessments. So it's not something you just pay and you get. You pay a fee and then qualified assessors show up unannounced and then check your beer for temperature, for appearance, for aroma and flavor. And it has to meet a minimum quality score. And every beer that you have that's tested, and we'll test up to 6 per visit. All of the beers that are tested that day have to pass. And then you have to pass a subsequent one. So you have to, all those beers that are tested have to pass at least twice. And then
does the inspector show up and announce himself or herself?
When you show up, you show some identification to the pub so that they know you're going to come at some point. And the management of the pub, or in this case here, tap rooms are increasingly where Cask Mark is. But the staffs there know that someone from Cask Mark will come, but they don't know when. And they normally what I do here is I'll at least tell who the person will be. And then we just ask that, they have proper identification. So, but again, you have no idea when that person's going to come. Wow. So it could be any time that the pub is open for normal customers.
Steve, that's a great intro. Let's go to Todd, because, you know, Todd, you've been on the show quite a bit, and you seem to be at the forefront of everything that's happening good in brewing and the tap rooms.
I'm just being dragged kicking and screaming, you know, all the time. I've definitely, and thank you for having me on the show again. It's always a pleasure. But, you know, having that tutelage, which I mentioned a lot in the past, you know, I started at Brickstore in 2005 and was there until 2016, you know, you're just around incredible beer for such a long time, it just becomes part of your DNA. So I knew for sure that, you know, when we opened this place that we wanted to have a draft list that, you know, was sort of echoing back to what we, what Brickstore has done so well for 26 years.
So I know you do a little beer fest, and we've talked about a lot of things that you're doing. But how does cask work into your brewery and you know, your take on it? And then I also want to dive into, like, what styles are really meant for cask. We can talk about that a little later, too.
Yeah, absolutely. So, again, that kind of starts at Brickstore. I think Brickstore has been pouring cask beer for 8 to 10 years, so or maybe a little more than that. But we had one or two engines, I think, for a while there, and we were not quick to get one in the beginning. Like, I think we had one before we opened, but it wasn't, like, on my radar. Like, I knew, again, the beers that we wanted to make were going to be, you know, classic-style beers for the most part. We still brew fun stuff, I guess you'd call it. But having, you know, 3 or 4 English beers was always going to be part of what we had going on. We had one engine for a while, and now we've got 2. And I guess earlier on, I tried putting different stuff in casks. And what I mean by stuff is different styles, like non-traditional English-style beers. And, you know, we have some dry hop lagers that, you know, did okay for, like, anniversary. But I feel like, for the most part, you know, you can't beat English bitter and, you know, paler stuff. So, typically, on our normal draft list, we'll have at least 4 to up to even 8 English-style beers. They sell excellent on draft, and we're still trying to introduce our, you know, our guest to cast beer. I think the ones who know really, really know. And, you know, for the rest of them, it's about education. And actually, we have Neil. He does beer school over at Brixor. He's been doing it for us for the last handful of months. And it really starts with, like, education with the staff. So if the staff know, care, and help curate, then that message translates to the guest. So they have to be excited about it first and foremost. But, you know, it's funny. We just put our first hazy beer on 2 weeks ago. First one in probably 4 months. And, you know, we make hoppy beers, hop-forward beers a lot. But, you know, I feel like the older I've gotten, I try to fight back some of the curmudgeon-y sort of disposition I might have. But, you know, I want to typically make and put on stuff that I want to drink. And I love English beer.
That's a great intro. And Neil, just talk about the Brixor and your new cask ale bar.
Sure. Yeah. To kind of pick up where Todd had left off, the pub did have one beer engine at our downstairs bar for a number of years. But to be honest, I would say 9 months out of the year, it sat empty. You know, most brewers weren't focused on making cask ale. And at this point in the story, we're talking, you know, 2008, 2010, 2012, brewers weren't looking at cask ale as traditional English dispense real ale. They were looking at the cask as a method to put bullshit into the beer, right? Like we all kind of remember cask ale, again, 2008, it's a cask, but it's really more about the adjuncts that you're putting in the cask. And it's this one-off, you know, 10.8 gallons of their IPA, but there's, you know, another 3 pounds of Cascade hops in it, or there's, you know, Rainbow Skittles or whatever the hell. So it seems like that was more often how cask was being presented, was just sort of as a vessel in which to put stuff into the beer. But even then, there wasn't a whole lot of cask ale going around of any sort. That being said, I think as the adjuncting of craft beer in general has really progressed, I mean, starting in, I would say 2014 or so is when you started to see brewers really, you know, throwing the gauntlet down and not being afraid to put these really wackadoodle adjuncts into the fermenter, into the mash tun. The casks kind of ended up sitting empty for the most part. And that's not to say that there weren't some breweries that were focused on traditional, you know, putting a great 3.4% English bitter into a cask. They were out there, but they were really few and far between. So I think the folks that were keeping the torch lit for cask ale were doing it for the right reasons. That being said, Dave Blanchard, who's one of our owners and our founders, has always been an Anglophile and has always loved the presentation and the history and the tradition of cask ale. So as things shut down in 2020, we took the opportunity during shutdown to focus on retooling some things around the pub. And we had this beautiful space. It's almost a balcony that overlooks the pub. It's indoors, but it kind of sits right behind our main bar. And it had always been kind of underutilized. It was a couple booths, a couple high tops. During shutdown, we kind of took that opportunity and said, wouldn't it be great if we could turn this into a really immersive experience? So we built a bar, we have four beer engines, and really decorated it and really made it feel like the coziest little English pub that you've ever been in. If it's really asses and elbows in there, you've got about 12 people that can fit in the cask bar. So it's cozy, it's intimate, and that intimate setting really allows us to have our staff, like Todd was saying earlier, have the staff engage with the guests and get them excited about what we're doing and say, hey, this is... check this out. We've got four beer engines. We've got Sierra Nevada Pale Ale on cask. And let's talk about what that means and how it really showcases different elements of the beer than if we were to have the same beer on a regular draft line or in can. And it's really been wonderful. People have been reacting really well to it. People are excited about it. And the big thing for us, too, is the brewers are excited about it. There's more and more breweries that are coming to us and saying we would be so honored, we would just be so excited if we could have some cask ale pouring here at the Brixor. And that's been really, really great. It's a blast. I'm actually drinking a Blue Jacket English bitter, the Style and Grace. So the folks at Blue Jacket have been kind enough to send us a bunch of cask ale, and the stuff's just phenomenal.
So that's why originally you guys wanted to have Greg Enghart on, even though unfortunately he couldn't make it for this show.
Yep, Church Key is doing some incredible stuff. Blue Jacket is brewing some incredible stuff. Those guys know what they're doing for sure.
Yeah. Well, first back to style. So, you know, when you mentioned having Sierra Nevada make a cask ale for their pale ale, how is that different? Let's talk this big picture of what cask is. How is a brewery taking one of their American styles and putting it into cask? How does that differ from the traditional English styles that are cask conditioned? You want to start with that, Steve?
Well, of course, in theory, any beer could be served out of a cask. But the problem is with casks aren't designed to really hold as much pressure. And a lot of beer styles, but certainly most lagers that we have are known for having much more carbonation. And the same thing for various Belgian styles that people like. They're better known for being really effervescent rather than having the softer condition that cask ale provides. So if we take something like an American pale ale, you know, a classic beer like Sierra Nevada, it's going to be softer than the standard draft or packaged versions of SNPA. And it's really interesting. I think it's most interesting to have these available in places where you can get the actual draft or keg or bottled, draft or canned or bottled versions just for comparison. So you'll get all of the basic features of the beer, but because the serving temperature is slightly warmer, we're talking cellar temp. So the beers are more aromatic, the hops shine through, just everything sort of comes out. And the flavors express themselves really a lot better than when something is really cold. If we're talking more like low 50s Fahrenheit versus 38 degrees Fahrenheit for a lot of beers. And I think it's really great to sort of see what you can do with a style, even a lager that's put in a cask. Again, it's never going to have the level of carbonation, but you may find that the flavors and aromas come through more elegantly. And it's a softer drink. Talk about less filling. I think that's one of the great things with cask ale is that it doesn't get you filled as much because it's just not as gassy a beer. So it's a smoother, more elegant drink. And I mean, as one who likes to drink by the pint or half liter or more, I appreciate when the carbonation is a bit softer because it goes down a lot easier and I'm less full. So the perfect.
Who wants to tell me the if we're talking about craft beer, which I remember Pete Brown wrote a book during the pandemic about craft, and the key was the handwork, the attention of a master craftsperson, which was only could be gained from the knowledge of repeated doing with your hands. What traditional cask ale, cask condition ale, what are the steps involved and the expertise that's required beyond just filling up a cask and putting it on the bar?
Well, in fact, normally the cask wouldn't be on the bar. Casks are really the shape of the cask, everything about them. They're designed to be, again, not at the bar. You can certainly serve them on gravity, but they're meant to be kept in a cool cellar where the temperature is more controlled. And not in the same refrigerator spaces your kegs because you want the temperature to be not warm. That's one of the great myths is that the Brits drink their beer at room temperature. No, they're drinking cellar temp, which is we're talking 10 to 15 degrees Celsius, more like 52 degrees Fahrenheit And I always say, if you think that's warm, go out in a t-shirt and shorts on a 52 degree day. I'm in Chicago, and here we're sort of 50 degree day. Some people may break out the shorts and t-shirts, but we're used to the cold. So maybe that's a little warmer, but it's not warm beer. So the most important thing is, do you have a separate space where you can keep the beer at its cellar temp? And then the question is it, can you maintain that temperature through the line and through? Normally these are hand pumped. So a lot of early attempts, people were just running beer line and it would not be through a chilled siphon. So that by the time you got the beer, the beer line was exposed to warmer temperatures as it in its transit to the beer engine and to the bar. And by the time it comes out, it's lost, even if it was cellar temperature in the cellar, by the time it comes out of the hand pump, we're talking 60, sometimes 70 degrees. So it's having that dedication at a place that's serious into this, to have the dedication to invest in proper equipment that maintains the temperature until it's nice and perfect in your glass. But the biggest thing that I think people forget about is that the person who's handling the beer in the cellar, we talk about a cellarman, which is different than a cellarman in a brewery. The cellar person, because of course there's no gender to being in charge of cask beer in your cellar. The cellar person has to understand how you bring that beer that you've received to the proper maturity and to serve it properly. And a lot of that, there's some crazy little steps that you have to go through to adjust the levels of carbonation and get it so that it is optimized and that you have the right balance of condition and that it pours really well out of the beer engine. None of this is rocket science. There are books that are available, and now because we're in modern day, you go online and find all sorts of guides for how to do cask ale properly. But it does require that step, and it's not as simple as just taking a keg, hooking it up to your tap system, and dispensing it. Even though Neil could tell you, and most anyone who's in the business, Neil and Ty could tell you, it's not as simple as that either, because you still have to balance your lines for the proper carbonation and pressure so that you're pouring a good pint. But it's that, I think the thing that everyone forgets is the maturation step, that people are rushing things. And, Pete Brown talking about what makes things craft, I think it's kind of slowing things down a little bit. We're not in such a hurry to get the beer served, that we want to get the most important thing is to make that beer elegant and beautiful in the glass and a great experience to the drinker. And I think that's why those of us who love cask ale appreciate the extra steps, the time and the skill sets that are involved. So it's more than it takes dedication and investment and time. So I think that's
great intro. Let's go back to Neil and Todd, if you guys want to talk about handling the cask. For you, Neil, like in the cask dedicated bar, things you're learning, steps you're taking, when do you know that cask is ready to serve?
Sure. Well, we're incredibly fortunate that we have a cellar that's located right behind where our cask bar is located. It's a pretty decent sized room, and we keep it at 55 degrees Fahrenheit year round. We keep our vintage beer in here, and it's just the perfect cellar temperature for cask ale. So we have a lot of room. So we have, I'm staring at them right now, we've got 7 different casks either hooked up or conditioning or that just arrived that are settling out right now. So having that space to keep everything at the correct temperature, and to Steve's point, give it the time to mature, give it that maturation period, has been really, really great. The toughest part of the job is always drinking the beer. And that's what I've got to do every morning, because as soon as that cask is tapped, the clock's ticking. That's not the situation with hooking, you know, a good word IPA up in a keg. And like Steve was saying, you know, you've got CO2, you've got every, a sealed vessel where there's definitely artistry behind keeping your draft system clean and balanced and all that. But, you know, we're very fortunate in that through the efforts that we've made to educate guests and to get our staff excited about our cask program, we typically don't sit on a firkin, a full firkin, for more than 2 days. If we get past that, you know, we're tasting these casks every single day, making sure that they're not past their prime, making sure that we're not detecting any off flavors. First and foremost, to make sure that guest's experience is the best that it can be. And second of all, like Steve was saying earlier, you never know who's going to walk in the bar. And I think it's actually really funny. Our first cask mark visit was from Steve, and I had no idea he was coming, and we hadn't even initiated our entry into the program yet. I happened to have run into Steve a couple times, and literally I was walking around the pub and I see Steve. I'm like, I know you, you're the cask guy, right? Chicago. Yeah. And we started talking, and I said, oh, you know, we were actually just talking about how wonderful it would be if we could get involved in the cask mark certification program. And he literally like reached in his breast pocket and pulled out a visit score sheet and said, all right, you want to do your first visit now? I keep that interaction always in the back of my mind, not only with the cask program, but with everything at the pub. But you never know who's walking through the door. So if people have heard about this great cask program and they've heard we've had Sierra Pale Ale, or they heard we have Good Word English Porter, or we have all these great beers on our cask program, and then they walk in and it's, let's say, freezing cold, or let's say it's flat, or let's say there's an off flavor, that sucks. I wish I had a more eloquent word for it, but it sucks, and it's not doing a service to the pub, and it's not doing a service to cask ale in general. We really feel like we're proselytizing for upholding what they're doing in the UK here in the US. To answer your question a little more directly, it's a lot of work. It's taking the time, it's taking the effort, and then it's tasting the beer every single day to make sure what we're putting in front of a guest is the absolute best representation of what that brewery is doing.
Well, and over to Todd. Todd, I know you're a brewer too. If you're making a cask ale, cask condition ale, you know, you're sending it off with love. Is it inoculated? What are the techniques that you're doing? And also, what's different about sending out a cask than a regular keg?
First off, I love what Neil said. That was great. And it made me think about how Brickstore is just like pushed out all of these, you know, folks who have this great love and I know passion's like overused, but it's like really love for like blue collar work. And that cast definitely feels like an extension of all that. As far as our approach to making English beer, you know, when it comes time for like a new recipe, we have four that we make all the time. There's a handful of brewers that reach out and they want to do an English style collab these days with us or a lager beer, which is really cool. Opposed to the ones that probably get a little more excitement from the general craft beer drinkers. So we get a chance to make a lot of them. But we design the recipe with, you know, what do we want to drink? That is where I always want to start with. And you know, what does our tap list look like right now? And what does it look like in a few weeks and all that, just so we don't overcrowd the tap list with too many bitters, which sounds like it couldn't happen, but it can. But we don't send a lot of cask beer out, to be honest with you. You know, not many people know how to handle it. I think that, you know, you can obviously tell Neil does, Greg Ingert, for sure. There's just, you know, we had one coming to us. Actually, we had two coming to us. I won't say from where, but it was put on a truck and then sent over. And, you know, one popped en route. And it's just, they're a delicate little thing, you know. And so we're just really careful about it. We don't send them out too often. Every now and then you might find one in North Carolina. We've got a lot of folks that we appreciate. And they appreciate what we do. So we might see one go up that way. But I think on hand we have about 30 of the pens and then about 18 firkins. So as far as process goes, you know, there's two approaches to it. we like to spund our lagers too. And I look at both that level of sugar when we add a spunding valve and when we're ready to put, you know, English beer or whatever into a cask. We're going to make sure that if we're not going to add any priming sugar, that it's close enough in its, you know, finishing of fermentation that it's not going to be overly carbonated. I learned my lessons the hard way. This is our 6th year of being open and doing cask beer now. So I learned early on that those things will pop and, you know, you have to be careful. So one approach would be to fill those casks when they're, you know, Play-Doh or so north of their terminal gravity. But what we typically like to do, just because I want to make sure it's going to be really right, that's what we do about 90% of the time, is, you know, we actually get beer over to Neil or when he comes up for beer school, because I don't know if you, I think he mentioned it, but he's an advanced Cicerone, so he's got a great palate. We have him, you know, taste and pass our beer for any BDK or any sort of all flavor. And once that's passed, we like to soft crash the beer down to about 60 degrees. And then we will fill the casks and add a little priming sugar and a tiny bit of Biofine, which helps clear the beer up. And like Neil and I think Steve both mentioned, you know, we're not in any rush. Like, whenever you're, hopefully you get a chance to come and see us, Jimmy, we don't have a ton of floor space, but we have casks on the floor all the time. And so we like to let cask beer sit at least 7 to 10 days. And then after that, we don't rush to put in the walking because we also have limited space there, but we usually try to, you know, bring it down for at least, you know, 12 to 24 hours in a walk-in, just so there's not any sort of accidents in a truck or a car or whatever it may be. And then about, you know, 24 to 36 hours before you want to tap something, we, you know, add our spile and make sure the pressure's coming down. And then, yeah, we've got two beer engines here, so we like to, you know, make sure they're nice and clean and have something rolling. We don't always have both engines rocking, where our program is definitely in its infancy compared to, especially to Brickstore or Blue Jacket or Church Keep for that matter. But yeah, we always have one on at this point, and it's awesome.
Wow. Hey, Steve, you know, when we were planning out this episode, we emailed a little bit, and I told you that at Nerex, before we talk about, you know, classic English cask conditioned, I told you that I'd had a couple different beers in Boston. One was one that I liked. Todd Mott at Tributary Brewing in Kittery, Maine, had a California Common on as a cask. And it of the American beers, it really stood out for me. So tell us about the California Common style. Why do you think that that came across well in cask?
Well, the California Common is – basically defined by one brand, which was Anchor Steam. And since they control the copyright on the name, no one really could make a steam beer. But what Anchor Steam was designed to be, you know, there was a history of trying to make lagers in warmer climates. So they're effectively using shallow fermenters, and the fermentation that takes place is somewhat more ale-like. So the fact that again, it's still defined as having pretty high carbonation levels. But if you think about the yeast character and the complex palate you get from its levels of conditioning, that it normally they're fermented more in a traditional British style open fermentation, and in their case, kind of shallow vessels. So it's no surprise that the common that a brewery produces displays some really nice characteristics in the cask. But the one thing that it won't have that you'd get in a normal package version is a higher level of carbonation. And that's just because the cask can't hold it. But you can appreciate all these other flavors and aromas that may not be as evident in a beer that's 40 degrees Fahrenheit or lower.
Thank you.
Sure.
Neil, fill us in more with everything we're talking about, handling casks, you know, certain breweries that you're getting. I like this group. This is a great lineup, Steve, with Todd and you and Neil. This is like all three sides of this game. I love it.
Hey, that's dynamite.
Neil?
Hey, sorry, my internet's been kind of cutting in and out. I apologize. So, sorry, Jimmy, you were just asking about kind of general handling of our casks over here?
Yeah, keep that going, because it's still fascinating to me. I know that, you know, most of us really don't know how to handle casks, and even we've tried and we haven't done it well. So
sure. I can't emphasize how lucky we are to have a large enough space that we keep it 55 degrees Fahrenheit. So, you know, what, 10, 11 degrees Celsius, where we can fit a dozen casks if we need to. That is, it's such a luxury. I feel very fortunate in working with Steve that I've been able to do some of these cask mark visits. And some of those folks are running great cask programs and they're doing phenomenal stuff, but they don't have that cellar temperature space to condition their casks. So sometimes those casks are coming from essentially like a walk-in temperature, and they're going pretty quickly straight onto that beer engine. So you end up with cask ale that's very, very cold, which is, you know, it's not appropriate. You're going to get dinged on your cask mark visit for having cask that is too cold. You know, I don't want to say concession, but sort of the concern for folks when it comes to temperature is the guest perception. If you don't have staff that is articulate and staff that's excited about teaching about cask, then what you end up with is a guest ordering a beer because, you know, the California Common that you were just talking about, maybe they order it because they know what a California Common is, but they don't know much about cask. The beer comes out, they think it's warm, they think the carbonation's too soft. So if you're having that conversation with the guest over and over and your staff isn't explaining, well, look, it's all about allowing more of the nuance of the beer to shine through because of the temperature. And it's about tradition when it comes to serving these English style beers or these American style beers. I guess the point I'm making is if you're having to apologize over and over that the beer is not cold enough, then I think there's an inclination for some of these folks to maybe keep their beer a little bit too cold when it comes to their cask ale. So that's something that, again, sometimes it's out of necessity, and sometimes I think there's an inclination among the publican or among the tap room manager to maybe turn that cooler down a little bit if they have their cask in a kegerator. And that's really not what it's about. I know you're probably going to have that conversation with a number of guests that are thinking their beer isn't served at the correct temperature, but it's really having that staff that's able to explain and articulate and get the guests excited about what they're experiencing. So that's, let's say, one thing I have noticed when it comes to keeping and storing, and when it comes to cask service at some other places, is the temperature is such a huge thing. It's, you know, like Steve was saying earlier, this isn't warm beer. It's not meant to be warm. It's meant to be cellar temperature. But what I see more often than anything is the cask being served too cold. And that's just something that folks really need to be cognizant of.
What does the two, I mean, I understand there's different styles of beers should be served at different temperatures, but I still think that most people don't understand that. And then how does a too cold pint of cask impact the flavor?
Sure. You know, the reference point I always use is, look, you got Coors Light and it's got the mountains on the side of the can that turn blue when it's ice cold. They want that beer ice cold. They want it as cold as possible so you don't really taste it. You know, when you bring the temperature down on that beer, it mutes and masks a lot of the flavor, a lot of the nuance. And that's really antithetical to what cask is about. Cask is about really showcasing nuance and showcasing. I like that Steve keeps using that word elegance. Showcasing the elegance of these beers, and that elegant quality, those nuances, just don't exist in beer that is too cold. That goes for our regular CO2 draft beer as well. You know, there's definitely some folks that aren't too familiar with some of the beer styles or really our approach to beer that will say my beer is not cold enough, even on our regular draft line. So then getting that guest not only past the draft being a little bit warmer, a little bit closer to cellar temperature, but then throwing them in the deep end and, hey, this is cellar temperature. This is beer that served at you know, 11, 12 degrees Celsius. This is beer that's served at 55 degrees Fahrenheit. It's the line that I try to impart upon the staff is, look, it's just, it's allowing more of the nuance, more of the subtlety, more of the, what makes these beers interesting and unique is really going to shine through at that cool temperature rather than at a very, very cold temperature.
Yeah. And Neil, just a little more about your service at the Brick Store. Give me a couple examples of different styles of beer that you have on your regular draft system. And how do you control like the carbonation and the temperature, for example?
Sure. It's, you know, I've seen places that have more advanced draft systems. You know, I've seen plenty of places that have the flux capacitors and, you know, their ability to fine tune a lot of the pressure on each of these lines kind of on the fly, which is great. We don't have that. So it is a lot of tweaking and a lot of playing with regulators on each of these lines. Really, at the end of the day, it's staff education, you know, and it's I love when a staff member will come up to me in the middle of service and say, hey, I was about to go run this stout to the table. I think it's a little too cold. I love that. That makes me so happy.
Neil, you're awesome. Let's just take a minute and we're going to take a short break. We'll be back in a few minutes on Beer Sessions Radio. All right.
This episode is brought to you by Roberta's, home of Heritage Radio Network for 10 years. Roberta's was founded in Bushwick in 2008 and has become one of the most iconic restaurants in the country. HRN made its home inside of Roberta's in 2009, and together they have become part of the DIY fabric of the neighborhood. Roberta's, the pizza restaurant, is open for lunch and dinner 7 days a week and serves much more than just the famous wood-fired pizzas. Their team dreams up new salads, pastas, and sandwiches on the regular. Roberta's Tiki Bar is alive and well in the back garden, serving up frozen drinks in the summer and hot toddies in the winter. Stop by the bakery and takeout spot next door for fresh breads, sticky buns, and pizzas to go. But Roberta's also extends beyond Bushwick, with multiple locations in New York City and now in Los Angeles. You can also find their frozen pies in grocery stores around the country. The spirit of Roberta's, like Heritage Radio Network, is everywhere. Here's to many more years of pizza-powered radio. Learn more about Roberta's at robertaspizza.com.
Hey, welcome back to Beer Sessions Radio on Heritage Radio Network. It's our 14th year on Heritage Radio Network, and we're talking about Cask Ale, our second Cask Ale episode for May 2023. We've got Steve from Caskmark and Neil from the Brick Store Pub and Todd, our good buddy from Good Word Brewing. So Steve, back to Caskmark. It's pretty neat. I remember when you guys launched it in the States, I don't know, maybe around 2015-ish. There was a little excitement, but it seems that it takes a lot of work and a lot of dedication to do this right.
Well, absolutely. I think the other question is a lot of places think that this is a simple process and that I think Paul Pendyke said probably in our previous show back at, right before the pandemic hit, that a lot of people jumped onto the cask bandwagon because they saw the hand pumps and they thought it was cool. And they had no idea what was involved in actually serving these beers properly. So, you know, there was always this spike in usage and then that fades. And once people realize that it's not quite a turnkey operation. So, I think there are enough people today, and I think with the boost in having tap rooms, because a lot of people who know best how to do this and will take the time to do cask ale properly are people at breweries as opposed to at pubs that are separate operations. So if it's in a brew pub or a brewery tap room, you tend to have staff that's there that's available regularly that's really dedicated to doing this properly and will take the time. So I'm seeing a burst, particularly post-pandemic, and that's why it's no surprise. I've got 10 new Caskmark clients And that's more than double what I ever had at any one time since I started doing this. And the places that are doing it are places that have always had that dedication. Again, Greg Anger, we've talked about Blue Jacket, his place in DC, and Church Key, which was before that. But he also has the Grand Delancey in New York City. They got their accreditation in the last month. So they're on board. And he has a new place in New Orleans called Brewery St. X, where they do open fermentation, a lot of traditional lagers and British style ales. And they have just passed their second assessment. So, in fact, I'm packing up their stuff to send them their cask mark, plaque, and swag. So they should be getting that pretty soon. But it's that dedication. But there are other places, I think, seeing what's happened with guys around Atlanta and Athens, you know, so all of a sudden, here's a community in Georgia. And this is what I think some of us always felt was going to work, was we'd have to have communities where not just one place had it, but multiple sites had it. And it becomes almost competitive and a one-upsmanship. And it means, hey, can you do this properly? And it's like, or is your game good enough? So it happened in Los Angeles with McLeod Brewing Company. And then there was a place called Yorkshire Square, doesn't exist now, that they sold recently and became Project Barley Square. They're in Torrance. The former brewer from McLeod Brewing became the head brewer at Yorkshire Square. And he said, hey, you know, we want to do it now. So it's having multiple places in a market means better for everyone. And it also means that you're not going to let your guard down because you're not the only game in town. But is your game good enough? And I think the more places we have that in D.C. now that there are multiple places, and there's another location, not through Greg, but through guys up in Rockville, a guy named Kurt Harpole, just one of the owners and of True Respite Brewing in Rockville. And it's just a small tap room and they do one cask. And they will do, we're talking about doing weird beers and, you know, the shive hole is kind of an excuse for putting stuff in beer that maybe doesn't belong. They'll do some non-traditional casks. But I think there's a future for doing that, but they still tend to do more brown ales and milds and bitters, things that are more that express themselves better. And they're not one-off kind of gimmicky beers. So that's always been the problem we have with cask ale is that, okay, you're gonna put all this spice, you're going to put all this other junk in it. People drink it. They go, okay, that was interesting. I've had that. I never want that again. If that's your introduction to cask ale, it's not really a good one. So another interesting point Neil was mentioning in his experience, a lot of times he's finding that cask ale is too cold. In my experience with cask mark, the number one reason for places to fail the cask mark assessment is because the beer is too warm, not too cold. Even in the U.S., it's too warm. And it's because people don't have good temperature controls in place. And beer that's too warm, even in Britain, people don't find palatable. So you can imagine that, you know, that's a real no-no. I mean, I always joke with people, it's like, you know, if you give me a cask ale that's too cold, I can let it sit in my glass and it'll warm up. But if you give me a warm glass of cask ale, it's never going to cool down to cellar temp. So, yeah. So
you said cellar temp was about 52 degrees Fahrenheit, and Neil said he keeps his at 55. Is there a noticeable difference between the two?
It's a range. I think I wouldn't go higher. I mean, 55 is, I think, the limit that's there. So you always have to think about what you're serving that beer, what temp you're serving it, because once it's in the glass in person, you know, if you've got a classic imperial pint, that's a sizable quantity of beer. And if that glass is sitting there for a while, it's just getting warmer and warmer. So, you know, if you want that beer to stay cool in the glass, I would err on the side of starting a bit lower because it's going to warm up once it's served. So that's the same thing. If you give me a beer that's a little too cold to start, it's going to warm, make it a little warm, and I can drink it at the optimal temperature. But if you give me something that's too warm to start with, I can't cool it down. And I'm not going to throw ice in it, so.
That's a good point. Hey, back to Todd. So, Todd, let's talk about your ultimate cask beer experience. A memorable cask that you've had, the setting. Was there romance involved?
That is hilarious. No romance. Well, I guess romance for friendship or fellowship was involved. And I'm actually going to text my friend Maddie Hargrove to figure out where the hell we were. What beer we had, because it was amazing. We were in Red Schilling for their Oktoberfest in September, and we'd already had a little too much to drink, to be honest with you, and he got a wild hair to go and drive to this really well-known place, and it was like 40 minutes out of the way in Vermont, and we went over there, and we had some cask beer. We had other things, too, but I can't remember the name of the cask itself, to be honest with you, and I hate that, because somebody just mentioned one of their other beers the other day, and I was like, yeah, I had, you know, this bitter from those guys, and it was fantastic, but I think that as long as, you know, you're surrounding yourself with good company and the beer's quality, and to these guys' points, not, you know, not too hot, not too cold.
Where were you in Vermont? Do you know the brewery?
I'm going to message him. I won't hold everybody up, but I'm going to message Maddie and ask him what the name of that place was. Don't wait for me. I'll figure the name out, and I'm sure he probably remember. I feel like it was like, not Bluebird, but something like that. I'm forgetting the name of this beer.
Yeah. Well, we've had, you know, let's go back to the English style. Also, when I was talking to Steve, he said, even with travel to the USA, the best beers, as in cask ales from the UK, should have been superior to ours. Now, maybe you're talking about the Coniston Bluebird.
Yes, it is. Yes.
So I still remember that the same with some of the importers over the years having like a Coniston or a Ridgeway that really did come in. I mean, that was also a tribute to the importer and distributor, that with my limited knowledge of handling it, we did have a wonderful cask, put it on the bar, served it from the spout, and those were memorable. We also tried to go through it in one night as well. Yeah, Coniston Bluebird. Oh, yeah. And then I think at Nerex they were talking about the landlord, Timothy Taylor beers. Yes. Neil, do you get any beers from the UK for your cask engines?
We don't generally, unfortunately. The Coniston Bluebird is one of the only authentic UK bitters that I've seen available. And I don't recall having seen any actual firkins of that recently. It's funny you bring up Landlord, though. That's one of my all-time favorite beers. And when you asked Todd about that, you know, kind of consummate cask experience, it was Timothy Taylor Landlord at White Locks in Leeds. It's just this unbelievably gorgeous pub, and Landlord is a top five favorite beer of all time for me, for sure. So that's something that I've been sending messages to the Timothy Taylor folks. I know some other folks have kind of a social media rapport with those guys. We're working on it, because having authentic Timothy Taylor Landlord on cask here at the Brick Store would be, I could retire after we get that done. I would just, I'd hang it up and say, it's not going to get any better.
What is it about that brewery? Cause I've only had it in the bottle. It might've been a bottle condition, Timothy Taylor Landlord, years ago. It was the talk of Nerex also, that everyone was wanting to get a Timothy Taylor Landlord in cask.
It's such a wonderful, balanced, interesting beer. There's a lot of beers that I really appreciate, you know, cask or otherwise, that there's so much complexity and there's so much to pick apart, you know, like a wonderful lambic. There's so much there, and there's so much to really dive into. And then there's some beers that are there just to kind of throw back, plenty of beers that, you know, not one note, but might be a little more straightforward. And Timothy Taylor really walks that very, very narrow line between both. It's got so much complexity and so much nuance to it, but at the same time, it's such a refreshing, just crushable, lovely beer. It's I need to work on a more eloquent explanation of why that beer is just the best.
Now, well, how about this? Tell us more about that, the pub that you drank it in, because if we're talking about Catskill, why don't we talk about a couple places in England that are doing it right on premise?
Sure. White Locks in Leeds. It's also kind of connected to a place called Turk's Head. It's down a little alley. It's been there, I want to say, since the late 1800s, if I remember correctly, and they clearly haven't updated any of the decor or anything since the 40s or 50s. Brass, stained glass. It's looks like something out of a Jules Verne novel. It's copper and brass and carpet, and it's just the loveliest place to drink beer. And then not only is it this gorgeous setting, but they've got probably six or seven beer engines and a wide variety of styles. Great traditional English food. It's just a lovely place.
Well, that's great. Steve, what about you? Any great moments or tell us about the really good English pubs that you'd go to if you were going to England to drink cask?
That's always a loaded question for me, because I've been to the UK like 50 times. I used to go more often. I used to go, three or four times a year. And haven't recently, but it would be, there are just hundreds of places that I've been to that stand out. I think sometimes what we forget is that it's less important to have a lot of beer engines available, a lot of beers that are available. Sometimes the best beer is at a pub that serves one or two or three beers, but each of those beers is served perfectly. And those are kind of places that stand out more to me than a place that has, a dozen different cask ales. The more cask ales you have, I think there's been a discussion here about, hey, these are beers that don't have a long shelf life. And unless you're using a device called a cask breather, which basically blankets the beer in the cask with CO2, so it's not adding pressure, it just preserves the beer so the shelf life is a little longer. Cask beer is going to go bad in 3 days. So the more beers you have available, more cask beers you have available in a pub, the more likely one of them is not going to be right, because you can't guarantee that all of them are going to pour beautifully unless you're getting a huge crowd. So, we have a tendency in this country to look at places that have, so many taps. And what you really should look at is how many beers they have that are served brilliantly. And that's where Caskmark comes in. So I think when you're traveling in the UK, there is an app. So there's a Caskmark app. And you can even find Caskmark pubs using the Caskmark app. In the US, it's just a little harder to see them because they're so few and far between. But in the UK, where you have 10,000 Caskmark pubs, you go most anywhere and you can use the app. And based on your location on your phone, you can find places that are that have been certified. Some pubs are great just because they're great places. And when I think of those, I think of Samuel Smith's pubs, both in Yorkshire, and then there are a number of Samuel Smith's pubs in London. They're beautiful pubs, but Samuel Smith basically only has one cask beer. And that's it. They have Old Brewery Bitter. And they have no other. Most of the beers you're going to get at a Samuel Smith's pub are their own keg products. But the pubs themselves are gorgeous. So you go there and you look at the place and you say, oh my God, this is a beautiful place to have a drink. And yeah, so there's that's involved too. So a lot of places, I just love going there because the pubs are really cool, but the beer may not live up to the pub. So it's like, can you find a place that is a landmark both in its appearance and also serves brilliantly kept beer? Well, then you're in heaven. And then those are a lot fewer. So I would say
those would have cask mark.
I would say this: almost every place where I've had the best pints, are Caskmark pubs now. They, you know, a lot of these places that I went to didn't have the Caskmark because the program didn't exist then. But almost any place that really does it right, the Caskmark certification sort of follows. So, you know, it's almost the one nice thing about Caskmark is that it's basically a guarantee of quality. In other words, if you get a bad pint at a Caskmark pub, you can complain about it. So, you know.
And they'll talk, well, and they'll want to talk to you
about it. That's correct. Yeah, they're going to want to talk to you about it. So that's one of the guarantees is that, and really as part of the program, I think all places that serve good beer should do this, is that you, as part of a Caskmark pub, we expect all of our places to offer people a try before they buy. So I think that's good with any craft beer, that, you know, give them a taster and don't charge them for it, because you don't want them to invest this money and then be disappointed in the pint. Maybe it's not, a lot of beers are not for everybody. But so I find that if you don't oversell and don't talk about it as much, but offer them tastes of it, people are surprised at how good the beer tastes. Particularly the fact that it's softer conditioning and it's less filling and the flavors and aromas are really more prominent than in icy cold beers. So I know a lot of people who don't necessarily like a lot of beers can be persuaded to drink beers if they're cask conditioned. You just have to have them. And I think offering a taste of them to see what the flavors are like may turn someone into a cask beer drinker. So, and get you to appreciate the broader beer community. So, try before you buy. And Caskmark basically is a guarantee of a good pint. So if it's not good, we'll make sure that the word gets back to Caskmark, and we work with the pubs to make sure that the beers are better.
Well, Steve, we could go deeper. We could ask about the metrics for judging and more about the brewing, but I feel like that we all need to go to some of the Caskmark establishments and taste some proper pints, yeah, proper cask. The next time we talk about this, you know, maybe I should make my way to Grand Delancey and interview Greg Engert there. Would you recommend that as a next stop in my learning?
Absolutely. I have some guys in, I'm trying to get more places in New York, but Grand Delancey was one. There were folks that I know in New York City who would say, hey, you know, like Grand Delancey is a good candidate for it. And they had just opened. And of course, I didn't know at the time, but it was a Greg Engert pub. So that neighborhood restaurant group, they really look after their beers beautifully. So it was no surprise when I found out that it was, you know, part of Greg's enterprises there at the neighborhood restaurant group. But I had, I get contacted by people who are just beer drinkers who say, hey, I've been at a place and the cask beer is really good. Could you try and get them in Caskmark? So I'm really dependent on the word of mouth from dedicated beer drinkers around the country. And there's no guarantee that I can get them in the program. I mean, people have to pay. It's not much to be involved in the program. I've even lowered the price to make it easier. But I mean, basically we have to, there are some expenses involved in making sure that the beers are assessed. So, you know, we can't offer it for free. But a lot of places, even though they have great recommendations from customers, when I approach them and say, nah, it's not for us, we don't want to do it, we're not interested. So I want to remind people that just because they're a really good candidate, sometimes they're just not interested in being in the program. And that's okay. I'd love to have them in. But as long as they're, especially if they're doing a great job, I mean, it's an honor for me to have them as part of Caskmark in this country.
Well, that's Steve. That's been a great intro, a reintroduction. And I just want to close it up with Todd. Todd, what's going on at Good Word Brewing? How is Little Beer, and what's your next festival?
Well, Little Beer was it was awesome. It's our third year doing it, so we've learned a lot over the years and kind of spread things out on our town green this year, and it felt really full, and it was great, man. It's funny. I'm glad I knew we were getting a little long on time, but you know, I've been talking with Steve a little bit via email, and also with Country Malt. We use a lot of Thomas Fawcett malt. So he, James Fawcett, actually come into the States, I think around Great American Beer Festival time. And so I'm trying to link up with him, and hopefully I can convince Steve to come down and spend a few days with us. And just recently I was in Rhode Island hanging out with a brewery from Manchester called Track Brewing, and trying to coordinate with all three of these parties. Hopefully Steve, you're maybe available or amenable to it, but I'm trying to do something really fun. I'm still trying to figure out what exactly that fun means, but it'll definitely be revolving around English beer and food and cask beer and all that. So more details as I kind of flesh this thing out.
You know what, Todd, you think you might do it in the winter?
Well, you know, I want to say it might be around September, October, somewhere in there. We have an event called Le Bon, and I think I was on talking about that at one point as well. And we're planning on doing that. That's the Saison and Oyster Festival we have, but we might shrink that one down, to be honest with you. Like, it's a fun event, but, you know, it's, as you know, it is with cask beer, it's just really hard to get people excited about, you know, some of these styles. And as anyone who, and I know you put on events, it's costly. It's costly. So, you know, trying to make, you know, the event not lose money is always priority one as a small business. So
one time I was at a festival that had, they shucked 8,000 oysters. It was pretty fun, but I know they lost their shirts on it. I think my idea of a good time is one shucker and enough oysters for me and my friends. So.
Right.
Doing it right. Hey, and then thanks, Todd. And then Neil, also for you, again, a little closing words about Brick Store and your Cask Ale Bar.
Yeah, we're just always trying to find new ways to showcase our cask program and get more and more folks excited about it. It's always about finding new brewery partners because it's really, it's a collaboration between the pub and the brewery, figuring out, you know, what style they want to brew, what style we can accommodate here at the pub. So it's, you know, building those relationships with the Good Words of the world, the Blue Jackets of the world, the Halfway Crooks of the world. Yeah, we're very fortunate to have some really great brewery partners. So just continuing to expand that, you know, to have someone like Jeff Bagby say, "Hey man, I want to send you guys a cask. We don't send casks anywhere. We're going to be, you're going to be the only place outside of our tap room that has a Bagby cask." It's such an honor, and it gets us excited. So trying to find more brewery partners like that and get some more super cool, exciting stuff flowing through those beer engines.
Wow. Well, Steve, Neil, and Todd, thank you so much for joining me here on Heritage Radio Network. It's been a lot of fun, and I'm definitely ready to learn more about my favorite on-premise experience and just how good it could be in this country and the special places. I think I will be going to Grand Delancey probably sooner than later and trying to hook up with Greg Enghart too. So thanks so much to Armin Spengen, our engineer. I'm Jimmy Carboni. I'm the host on Beer Sessions Radio. We'll catch you next time on Heritage Radio Network. All right, guys, thank you so much.
Beer Sessions Radio is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network. Food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Awele, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.